Hello and welcome to the History Harmonus. I'm Simon and this is my brother Tom. Say hi, Tom.
Yo.
And today we're going to be reviewing a book which is a slight departure from our previous promised review, which was going to be The Deluge by Adam Tooze. I'm unfortunately we did start it and I found it too boring to read. I was really struggling with it, so Tom was very kind and let me choose a different book, which I've now obviously chosen and we've read and we're ready to review. So we're going to have to put the Toosie on hold indefinitely, I'm afraid, and go into another era. I chose a book called The Men Who Lost America by Andrew O'Shaughnessy, which is about British command during the Revolutionary War and the preservation of empire. So this is obviously set in the 18th century, covering events of the American War of Independence. It's a really interesting book. I found a very unique kind of perspective, writing a history of the American War of Independence largely from the perspective of the British, and particularly from the perspective of the British commanders and statesmen who were in charge of the war and who were therefore blamed. And this is where the title of the book comes from, The Men Who Lost America. So yeah, really interesting and quite unique, I thought, book about the American War of Independence, which is a subject that I had very little knowledge of before we started reading the book. But I'm keen to learn more about, especially having finished this. So I did really enjoy this book. So I think maybe we just kind of dive straight into it and talk about the book itself and how that's structured. So Andrew O'Shaughnessy wrote the book very much from the perspective of these senior statesmen and generals who were in command of the British forces during the war. And the book itself is divided into nine chapters, which are dedicated to one of each of these statesmen and or commanders. So it starts off with George III, who is, obviously the monarch who oversaw the war and who basically was blamed publicly for being the monarch who lost America. And then it moves on to Lord North, who was the Prime Minister, the Howe brothers, who were slightly ambiguously known as the Peace Commissioners, but also were in charge of the army and navy, respectively, during the early part of the war. Then there was a further chapter on John Burgoyne, who presided over the first major British defeat of the war. Then Lord George Germain, who was the Secretary of State for America. Sir Henry Clinton, who took over command of the armed forces in America in the second half of the War of Independence. Charles Earl Cornwallis, who obviously lost his army at the Battle of Yorktown and precipitated the end of the American War of Independence. And then finally, there are two chapters on Sir George Rodney, who was an admiral in charge of the Caribbean fleet, and the Earl of Sandwich, who was the first Lord of the Admiralty during the American War period. So each of these chapters then talks a little bit about their the character's life leading up to the war, their career, And then their actions during the course of the war, with a little kind of mini conclusion at the end of that chapter about what happened to them afterwards. So, Tom, do you want to kind of jump in and share some thoughts?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so I suppose that sort of overriding like theme or sort of like thesis statement that the author's trying to get across is that despite popular depictions, pretty much in all these, well, I would say all of these people mentioned in the book without exception are actually quite highly capable, competent people for the time that they lived in. And even if they perhaps didn't earn their place by pure merit, that they certainly sort of had a demonstrable sort of experience and were, you know, in general sort of doing the best to their own abilities, given the scenario they sort of found themselves in. And that's but certainly from popular culture, that's not always something that's appreciated or sort of displayed all that well. And I think in general that the book does a pretty good job. And I think coming away from this, again, you know, not particularly familiar with this period of history, I think in all cases, you know, it does a good job of sort of exonerating most of the people in this book. Although that said, I did read, yeah, Sir George Rodney, bad guy, don't like him. Didn't know he existed until a week ago, but yeah. He certainly has too much place in his credit when it shouldn't have. Yeah, so I suppose that's it. I have to sort of talk about more specific elements.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I also I think Sir George Rodney was definitely the villain for me as well. Emerged as a villain. Possibly the one man that I thought was actually not only quite responsible but irresponsible in his conduct and contributed quite massively to the defeat in Yorktown. But then had his reputation kind of salvaged because he beat the French Navy at the Battle of the Saints. In 1782, which then kind of salvaged his reputation. But had it not been for that, I think he would have borne a lot more of the blame. But yeah, let's get straight into chatting about it. And I think like what I thought we would do with this, because it's broken down into quite detailed accounts of the lives of these men, is not really get into that so much as to talk about the broad themes that emerged. And Tom, like you were saying, one of the key arguments in this book is that the men who lost America, as they are known, were actually individually really competent people, and they had a lot of experience in their respective fields, whether that was government, military or navy. They were really quite successful men leading up to the war, and quite successful during it in many respects as well. They enjoyed quite a lot of success, especially in the kind of early and middle parts of the war. And I listened before we recorded this episode to an interview with O'Shaughnessy, who said that, you know, part of the motivation for writing this book was to kind of illustrate how fine the line is between victory and defeat, and how, you know, sometimes historiography can write up an event as being, you know, a terrible disaster, and blame the people in charge and kind of, you know, lambast them for their negligence or corruption or whatever else it was. But in actual reality, the situation can be a lot more nuanced. And I thought it did a really good job of that. I think like what struck me about the certainly the early part of the book, which dealt with the kind of the situation at home, the view from London, as it's called in part one of the book, and also part two, which deals with the war in the north of America. One of the key themes that emerged a lot was how much the British underestimated or really overestimated the support that they thought that they were going to have from American loyalists. They believed erroneously that it was only a small faction of rebels who were involved in kind of stoking up the war. And once it got started, and once they had sent troops over to America, they thought that they would be kind of quite quickly joined by lots and lots of loyalists who would rise up and kind of almost win the war for them. And that obviously turned out not to be the case. But yeah, that was something that, sorry.
As on that point, because it kind of becomes what be the word? It kind of actually leads to more problems than it solves. That there is this belief, and I suppose maybe it's more out of hope than expectation, because they simply don't have the ability to send men in from, say, Britain at this point. To actually sort of resolve a lot of the security concerns on the ground. And so there's kind of this hope anticipation that there is a loyalist community out there that can sort of help fill this gap. But as they go on to say, it means that, especially early on, they kind of have to take a much more softer stance in actually sort of enforcing control in the conquered territories, which means that they're perhaps not able to stamp out the revolutionary forces or the revolutionary presence as much as they might otherwise. And that becomes one of the sort of growing problems, in that they're not a actually able to, fair enough, they're able to win the battles, but they're not able to sort of stamp out the revolutionary forces, which means that as soon as they move on, they sort of re-emerge, and essentially the battle is for nothing, really.
Yeah, exactly. They have they're dependent on loyalist support to hold the territory that they win. But that doesn't emerge, and they can't be seen to be too harsh, because that alienates people even further. And the kind of the solutions that they choose, particularly George Germain, and Lord North to a certain extent, in kind of bringing in mercenaries from Germany to try to make up the manpower deficiencies that they have in the British army, just kind of serves to further alienate the American population, because they're seen as being, the tools of the oppressors. They're seen as using mercenaries against people that, a few years earlier had regarded themselves as British subjects. So they're kind of, yeah, they can't really win. Whether if they prosecute the war too harshly, they are alienating the population. But if they don't go hard enough, which arguably they didn't do it early in the war, they're unable to stamp out the rebellion.
Yeah, no, another element of that is there was a, yeah, I am eating while we're doing this, so you may hear something, but that's just me chewing. The other element of that is that the British also resort to using Native American, all that serves to fill the immediate gap in the armed forces. It leads to, again, this sort of growing alienation between the revolutionaries or would-be loyalists and the British presence as well, because there seem to be sort of alien forces or sort of somehow disrupting the sort of nation state that they kind of are growing increasingly are increasingly thinking themselves as being.
Yeah, exactly. And there's this kind of slightly bizarre episode where Burgoyne is beginning his campaign, which led to the defeat at the Battle of Saratoga. But he made a point of using Native American soldiers to kind of help bolster his own forces, who were invading from Canada. But he gave this bizarre kind of statement where he essentially let them loose against the population, and said that no mercy would be shown to rebels, but also asked them to be gentle and kind to people and to show mercy where they could. So it was kind of like this bizarre mixed message that was being sent, and that was it kind of representative of the whole problem for the British during especially that period of the war. Yeah, so it was, I think that was noted by O'Shaughnessy as being one of the key miscalculations and the key factors that cost the British the war in America was that they fundamentally just underestimated the strength of the rebellion, the feeling of the population, how attached they became to the idea of independence, and they also completely underestimated or overestimated rather the support that they would receive from loyalists. So another good point that he makes, I think, is how quickly the American Revolution morphed from something that was quite, I don't want to say niche, but it was quite kind of particular. There were specific grievances that the Continental Congress started with, but during the course of the war, it became something much more universal. It became a kind of an issue of freedom and of the rights of man, and something much more, something that appealed much more to ordinary Americans rather than something that was maybe more kind of in the interests of a landed kind of elite or merchants, particularly in the kind of in its early gestation. And that's something that the British didn't really have to answer. They didn't have a an argument that was as appealing as the, you know, the call for independence that emerged during the war.
Yeah, I think is that aspect is attributed to Thomas Jefferson, right? Primarily. But yeah, it does feel like it's really the Declaration of Independence in 1776 which becomes like a key radicalizing element, and it's kind of from that point onwards, it you know it a conventional victory is no longer sort of adequate. It has to be sort of a total victory that that they didn't really have the means to execute, in my opinion, from what I see.
No, exactly. And then there's this kind of the issue of, I suppose, the direction of the military side of the war, and actually the military and the navy side, that kind of they're almost mutually antagonistic, where the government at home is pushing for a kind of a victory on land. So the first commanders in America on the British side, who were General Howe, William Howe, and his brother Admiral Richard Howe, work quite closely together in the early kind of years of the war. Admiral Howe very much supporting the operations of the army, But that necessitates kind of neglecting the what's it called, the blockade of America, and therefore allows supplies of weapons and ammunition and food and eventually soldiers from France and Spain getting to America and supporting the American cause. So there's this kind of like from the get-go a bit of a rift in London in the government about the very nature of the war, whether it should be essentially a military a land campaign or a sea campaign. And that part of the, you know, the emphasis for it being a land campaign was this belief in there being, you know, loyalist support, which didn't materialize.
Yeah, it kind of segues onto the part about the lack of resources, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah,
can
so.
do. Yeah, so basically, you brought up this point of the lack of resources to sort of address the scope of the war, and certainly once it's first the French and then the Spanish and then the Dutch kind of get involved, that the theater expands to an extent that Britain can't really cope with all of these competing sort of interests. And it's not just because I read The Rise and Fall of Great Powers recently, but the classic case of overextension. So the British at this point have overextended. They don't have the means to support themselves. And what one of the elements, especially with regards to shipping, is that the first Lord Admiral, what's his title? Anyway, Sandwich. Lord Sandwich. I have to say, really did like hearing Sandwich being used as a proper noun. It was quite amusing. But yeah, anyway, so he has the unenviable task of trying to build up the British Navy in a time of conflict, and is dealing with a lot of issues. So although he is actually, as it turns out, quite greatly experienced in this field, he has he participated in the successful Seven Years' War, I believe, right? And
yeah.
But at this point, the stock of, it's like treated wood or something that they need, is depleted, and other sort of key resources. And there's also competing claims as to like whether or not you need to repair existing ships or sort of build new ships, and where exactly those ships go in terms of like theaters. And so that's a key concern he has to deal with, and it isn't what either is ignored or deliberately ignored or isn't appreciated by his opponents. And he actually does a great job of, like, this kind of going off, he does a great job of actually resolving those issues in the course of this war, and he builds up like a 2-year supply of treated wood by the end of this conflict, which is important a bit later. But yeah, so anyway, shipping, the lack of shipping, and the lack of shipping infrastructure is a key problem they have to deal with, and is one of the problems why they have to, in the first place, make a decision between sort of placing them in the Americas or Europe, and then even within the scope of the Americas, like what the actual sort of key objectives are for the ships there.
Yeah, exactly. There's the kind of the competing need to try to support the army in America, particularly in North America, with supplies and with reinforcements of soldiers. Also trying to maintain a blockade of America to stop supplies getting to the Continental Army. But then also trying to protect the very valuable colonies in the Caribbean that Britain owns, and which are threatened by the French and the Spanish entry into the war in 1778 and 1779, respectively. And then finally, of course, there's the danger of a land invasion of Britain as well, which the French very cleverly play off of that fear by massing soldiers near Calais or was it Brittany. They massed them on the coast of France anyway, threatening invasion, which they actually, my reading of the book was that they didn't intend to carry out, but it was more thought up as a ploy to divert ships away from America, which did work. And like you said, any decisions had to be balanced against, like, you know, if you send one good ship, you're leaving a bad ship in its place. A lot of the shipping that Lord Sandwich inherited was in quite a bad state and was in need of repairs. A lot of the ships have been kind of maintained beyond their useful life, really, which was, according to O'Shaughnessy, only about 11 years, I think he says at one point, which I didn't know. I was surprised by it because I'm sure that I read somewhere else that HMS Victory, which of course was Nelson's flagship at the Battle of Trafalgar, was built during the American War of Independence. And I think it was still, I don't think it was completed in time to take part in that war, but that definitely, you know, meant that it served a lot longer than the 10 or 11 years that it was meant to have existed for.
Actually, I do, because that was in, I think, a series of lectures I listened to, they mentioned some of these things, and they actually gave the figure that, I don't know if maybe that was a ship of the line, I don't really remember what designation it was, but they said, like, an average, like, wooden sail ship at this point in time would take around 12 years to build, and was expected to have, on average, 12 years lifespan. So basically, you can imagine that it's very hard to actually increase the net supply of your ships, but to the point about HMS Victory, that was unusually quite an old ship by the time it was in service during Battle of Trafalgar. So okay. Yeah, that's not that is a bit of an exception. Also, side note, so I think it's kind of funny that, well, it's not really funny, I just find it a bit weird. So the new class of submarine the British Navy are building is designated Dreadnought, which you think they're kind of trying to tempt fate a little bit by using that name. I don't know. could look bad. But that's beside the point.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it doesn't bode well. Yeah, well, I've dragged us into the 18th century in this book review. We were in the realm of dreadnoughts and various other battleships of the early 20th century, but we're now kind of talking about first rates and third rates. But yeah, that was partly intentional because I am more interested in the early modern period to begin with. But
yeah, it is a nice change to hear like casualties in like the hundreds or thousands.
Oh yeah,
rather than the tens of millions.
Yeah, it was actually, that was quite surprising. I did find the size of armies. I mean, I know that Andrew O'Shaughnessy makes a point throughout the book that armies in the American War of Independence were quite small, even for 18th century standards and 18th century European standards. But the size of armies were like in the kind of, well, 5,000 soldiers in an army was quite a large force in that conflict, which was quite surprising, actually.
Yeah, well, because of the battle of, or the siege of Yorktown, which basically ends the conflict, sees the surrender of what, like 8,000 British troops and allies,
yeah.
And that represents a quarter of all of the continental army at that point.
Yeah.
So it gives you an idea of the scale. That is an interesting point. And that was the other kind of semi-related, and that like one of the criticisms of the British Army, or the generals of the British Army to an extent in the conflict, is that they're not actually using the contemporary tactics that you might expect in like continental Europe. But in fact, that's where they're able to employ those tactics, they are quite effectively. And that the main problem is really that that the struggle with the sort of guerrilla tactics, which typify a lot of these sort of what would you call it, like the general sort of attrition that they face during the conflict.
Yeah, it's not so much the set piece battles where the attrition is taking place, but the convoys that are being ambushed and the messengers that are being captured and all of that kind of campaigning attrition, I suppose, is where a lot of the damage is done to the British forces. And like you said as well, once the British start to win a foothold in firstly in New York and then later in the southern states as well, in North Carolina, South Carolina, they have to choose between concentrating their forces and attempting to bring the Continental Army into some kind of like set piece battle, or splitting their forces, dividing them, and placing them in defensive roles in the various kind of forts that were established around those states. And it's not something that they're able to really balance. So for example, in North America, William Howe, once he's conquered New York and overrun Washington's forces there, he then, instead of pursuing, diverts his forces into kind of a large number of different towns and defensive positions, which are then essentially picked apart by the Continental Army and the American kind of loyalists. Yeah, he doesn't have enough men to hold the ground that he's taken, or to make the kind of key gains that he needs to.
Yeah, that's very true. And again, that sort of comes back to the issue that they are sort of operating under the assumption that there's a slight undercurrent of loyal support or a loyal support for the British presence, which doesn't materialize, and it makes it that much more devastating when they do decide to split their forces, because they're not able to sort of hold the ground or sort of expand in any sort of meaningful way, without reinforcements from Britain itself.
And actually, something that you said earlier reminded me of another point that was made in the book, where the American, the Continental Army, and particularly the militia that made up a large part of that, their battle tactics were different from the British as well. Whereas the British kind of tried to fight in, well, in the book, O'Shaughnessy says that they didn't actually try to fight in line, and there wasn't this kind of tension, or there wasn't so much of the tension between kind of classical European linear warfare and skirmishing tactics that is maybe portrayed in popular histories of the American War of Independence. He does make the point, and I think quite well, that a lot of the commanders in America, crucially, William Howe and Burgoyne as well, had experience fighting in America during the Seven Years' War. And they did try to adapt skirmishing techniques and to make use of lighter infantry where they could. But they were still surprised, even though they made these preparations ahead of time and tried to train up more of their soldiers to function as light infantry. They were surprised by the accuracy of the American marksmen and the skirmishing tactics that they employed. They weren't really able to answer that, I didn't feel, at least not in not in a kind of long-term strategy.
Yeah, I don't really have anything to add to that. It's all good.
I found it interesting because I just it's one of not knowing much about the period. One of the things that I've always kind of thought about it was that it was very much this kind of like, classical linear formations pitted against more skirmishers. So it was surprising that they didn't actually that they anticipated that that would be the case and tried to adopt methods of countering it, but it didn't quite work.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm not. Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of classic a case of guerrilla warfare, sort of kind of. I don't really know what to say. Yeah, so but it seems like it's kind of an insurmountable problem. In general, I don't think there is really example of any occupying force having that much success against it, especially when it's not. Because yeah, I suppose that will be the other aspect of it, right? Because it's not really a conventional war in any means, because it's not well, what one of the issues politically as well, right, is that it's not a conventional war against sovereign nations. It's effectively a revolution rolled up into like a civil war almost, and that becomes one of the elements. So it's quite hard to for everyone. But both militarily and sort of politically, to sort of understand how to sort of approach this, which is one of the compounding factors of why it becomes challenging to have a unified sort of approach, a sort of plan to execute as well.
So should we talk a little bit about the about the political situation that kind of underpins the British response to the war? So there
Sure.
was this kind of tension right from the beginning, and even really before the war started, between various factions within the Houses of Parliament in England, but also within the government factions around the various ministries, who felt at different times that the war should take different directions or be prosecuted in different ways. And there was even kind of there were questions about just the very nature of whether or not Britain should be at war to begin with, or whether they should try to seek an armistice and a kind of negotiated peace. Right at the beginning of the book, as O'Shaughnessy talks about George III and how he was initially quite, despite being labelled a tyrant by the founding fathers, he was initially quite opposed to the policies that led to the Boston Tea Party and ultimately led to the issues that created the war. But then once the fighting actually started, he kind of changed tack almost 360 degrees. He kind of decided that the war had to be prosecuted, and that the British had to win, and that the sovereignty of Parliament had to be kind of stamped, and the authority of Parliament had to be stamped onto the American rebels. So he kind of went from being quite a conciliatory voice in the government to being quite a hawkish voice. And he really, alongside George Germain, who was the Secretary of State for America, really pushed this idea that the war had to be won and had to be prosecuted, and that if it was lost, then there would be dire consequences. Whereas Lord North, who was the Prime Minister, And a lot of the generals as well felt that, well, they initially opposed the war, although Lord North had been in favor of quite harsh penalties against the Americans for trying to kind of resist taxation, and so he was kind of responsible for creating the situation that led to the war. But once it erupted, he wanted to make peace, and he was quite opposed to prosecuting it. So there's this kind of weird schizophrenia happening within in the government that I think, was represented on the ground with the different tactics that were chosen, or this kind of strategic picture that was chosen, and the changing strategic picture during the war.
So because like George the Third is quite interesting. Well, he has an interesting role in this because although he's very much just a figurehead by this point, because this is once the his sort of actual power is a lot lessened compared to the Parliament. But he's still very much sort of a central focus and sort of a driving force behind at least a perception of which policy to execute. And he is quite somewhat conciliatory. He's very much opposed to a lot of the policies that led to the Boston Tea Party. But it's not, I can't quite remember when, but it's either from the start of the conflict or from the Declaration of Independence. He becomes a lot more, as you say, like hawkish in his attitudes to the war. And I'm not sure, partly it seems because he's no longer treated as some sort of intermediary or sort of some secondary figure by the revolutionary forces. He's sort of singled out as being like a key person who's sort of acting against the revolutionary's best interests. And that's quite a striking turnaround in that. And he doesn't, I mean, once that happens, he doesn't seem to change his mind all that much until the very end. It's very much like a turning point for him or his perception of the conflict.
Yeah, exactly. I think you're right. I believe it was a Declaration of Independence, or it might have been earlier, that he kind of adopted this much more stringent policy against America. But yeah, because the criticism of him kind of changed from being almost a traditional criticism of a king, which is like evil ministers having led him astray. And that the rhetoric in America changed from that perspective to one where he was actually held personally responsible for a lot of the policies, and it kind of stung him. And on the other side, you had Lord North, who was the Prime Minister and also the Chancellor as well. He had a kind of role that doesn't really exist in modern government, but he was initially quite keen on pressing the sovereignty of Parliament as an issue, and a kind of browbeating the American kind of revolution. But then once the fighting started, he became convinced that the war couldn't be won, and yeah, tried to advocate for a kind of negotiated peace. And also tried to resign several times as well during the course of the war, although he was prevented from doing so. But yeah, that's one of the things that I really enjoyed about this book, actually, the picture it gave of the society of London and Parliament, and all of the gossip that was passing between the various factions, the attacks that they made in the press, and the kind of just the general bitchiness, I suppose, of politics in that period was quite interesting and entertaining, I thought.
Yeah, that's quite good from that point of view. It puts me in mind of I recently read a bunch of his books. Oh, James Hawes. He uses a lot of primary sources just directly within the text. And it was quite good from that point of view of like enriching this sort of muddled picture that you might have experienced if you were alive at the time. But especially also just like just the language, it's so the language he uses is so flowery sometimes. It's quite funny to just read and think that this is just normal conversation, apparently. And especially, I mean, since we're on it, like Lord North was just the chapter was amazing to read. And also I was listening to it a bit as an audiobook and had some genuine laugh out loud moments. Not in the most appropriate place as well. But yeah, just some of the things that he came up with, because he was quite a witty guy. And it was something he sort of played up to a little bit as well, just if I can find some of the things that I quite liked. Oh yeah, what he was apparently fell asleep once during Parliament when a colleague was talking about national revenues and expenditure, and he got to a point of like 1689, bear in mind this is like 100 years later. And on waking up he says, like, zounds, you've wakened me 100 years too soon. And there's some really great stuff that he says. But it is weird as well just to think about, because contemporary UK politics are sometimes the complaint that the Prime Minister has far too many responsibilities for the role. It should be sort of separated much more. But this is a guy when, well, this is a time when he effectively is the Prime Minister. But it's, to be honest, I didn't really understand the use of that title, because he seems to insist he's like the First Minister and or just the Chancellor at some points. And I'm not sure if that's just to sort of back out of a difficult conversation or something. But effectively his very much split attention across multiple different concerns. And it's not just him as well, it's the military are very, very much concerned about very, very different theatres. But just the fact that he has to sort of operate in this very muddled way of working that he finds himself in, and sort of give time to very different concerns, must be extremely challenging. As well. But yeah, the other thing, what was it, the other thing, it was oh, he just is known for being a bit overweight as well, and that kind of led to his I suppose charm, if you will. Yeah, that kind of got a bit all over the place there. Oh yeah, no, that was it, the other thing. So he was, so despite all of this, no, I can leave it for later.
Okay. My incidentally, my favorite quote of his in the book was when he was accused in another parliamentary session of being asleep. He apparently had a bit of a reputation for sleeping during Parliament, which O'Shaughnessy says was due to the fact that he had so many responsibilities. He was working pretty much 7 days a week, and parliamentary sessions in that period frequently lasted until kind of midnight or beyond. So he had a very, very busy schedule, and he would often try to catch up on his sleep during particularly boring meetings. And so one of my favorite quotes from Lord North and from the book itself was where a colleague accused him of being asleep during a parliamentary debate, and he answered, "Would to God I were." I just loved it.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, because also apparently he had to attend far more sessions of essentially prime minister's questions, which
Yeah.
must be very challenging. And also, I
Yeah.
don't really understand the logistics of this, because presumably this is all in the older sort of medieval site of the Houses of Parliament, or what will
Yeah.
become the Palace of Westminster. And I don't suppose this part actually exists anymore, but I get the impression that this is a very small room with like hundreds of people in.
Yeah, they I think O'Shaughnessy makes a point in the chapter on Lord North that the there were 600 or just over 600 MPs at the time who were eligible to attend debates and vote, but the room itself was only about big enough for about 350 at a time. So yeah, it would have been very, very noisy, very stifling kind of environment for him to be in. And to his credit, he rode that, like he rode the waves of debate very, very skillfully, which was one of the reasons why, despite the fact that he had no faith in the British ability to win the war, especially after the French entry in the war in 1778, despite the fact that he tried to resign several times, and despite the fact that he continuously said that he didn't think that Britain could win, Jules the Third insisted that he remain as Prime Minister, because he was one of the few ministers that he believed was capable of garnering the necessary support in the House.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I did enjoy the Lord North stuff. It's very funny. I don't have much else to say about it, but
No.
yeah. I mean, to be honest, I don't have much to say about the military guys, because they're all kind of similar-ish. Feel like what a justice with a coin. Unfairly characterized. I don't know.
You felt that Burgoyne was unfairly characterized.
Well, but God, he lost in Saratoga, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, so I feel like, I mean, it's again with a lot of these, well, I suppose the general point of this book is that, none of these people are sort of operating in a vacuum, and are often, well, put another way, looking at the circumstance, and especially given the delicate balance of the resources that they had, and a somewhat underappreciated relationship between the navy and the army, the failure in one area could almost invariably lead to failure in the other. And so it seems like in sort of Burgoyne's case, it wasn't necessarily anything that he did particularly wrong. It was just like the balance is so fine, that there wasn't really much room for maneuver. That was the sort of main thing. And I guess, like, going on, like, I can talk about least favorite guy, George Rodney. So yeah, so similarly, so he's basically, I thought that was amazing though, because I don't think it was mentioned in any other chapters, but the idea that there was such like rife corruption, that he was spending like so much time just looting from like captured territories, much more so than actually doing his job. But that was just like what people did at that point in time. I don't know. Yeah, so basically he was almost, single-handedly responsible for defeat against defeat in Yorktown, because he wasn't able to secure the sort of naval access that was needed for the British. And in large part because he was sort of so self-involved with or self-interested in these securing loots. And also what was doubly annoying about this, and I guess it kind of comes to sort of final points, is that he seems to be largely exonerated because of the actions sort of almost immediately following the War of Independence, where he was able to secure a quite dramatic victory against the French Navy. And it's quite, I mean, to be honest, I wouldn't have known about this, but you know, to put into perspective, it was kind of like seen as, you know, on a level of the Battle of Trafalgar in terms of its importance and sort of outcomes for the British interests in the region. And that is a large part why he's looked on favorably. But I mean, it's doubly annoying, not only because he was had such a negative impact on the American Revolutionary War, but also because it seems in a large part that his success was largely a consequence of Lord Sandwich's good management of resources at home, which the latter is very not very much doesn't get any sort of appreciation for. And in fact, Lord Sandwich has actually came out quite badly from, well, at least professionally came out quite badly in the immediate aftermath, because he was one of the main targets for criticism of the British war effort in the UK, in the UK at least, or Great Britain, I suppose, will be at this point.
Yeah, exactly. There was that sense of injustice, I think, and kind of slightly arbitrary treatment of the all of the generals and the politicians after the war, that George Rodney, like he said, was probably. I mean, I was also biased when I read his chapter. I really didn't like the guy. He seemed so corrupt, and I mean. Shaughnessy makes the point that, you know, prize money was a thing at the time, that the Navy particularly, captains and sailors, officers particularly in the Royal Navy, weren't paid particularly well, and they didn't have much of a pension. So a lot of the time they relied on capturing booty, essentially prizes from enemy navies or enemy merchant fleets to make their fortunes. But even in a period that essentially rewarded kind of semi-piratical behavior, Rodney was singled out as being infamous for it and particularly corrupt. And he delayed action in the Caribbean because he was so busy looting one of the islands that he conquered. And then went back to Britain to defend himself in Parliament against the accusations of looting, rather than managing the fleet in the Caribbean at precisely the point that the French fleet was closing in on the Chesapeake Bay and blocking Cornwallis into Yorktown. So in my mind, he was the man most responsible for losing America. The military commanders, like you said, I think that I felt quite bad for a lot of them. They seemed to be doing the best that they could with the very limited resources and with the kind of mixed messages that they were receiving as well from the government in London. But he definitely did seem to just kind of manipulate the situation for his own benefit. And it's worth noting as well, he had massive debt problems, George Rodney, before the war. And I think he wrote a letter to his wife or his mistress during the looting of this island, saying basically, my problems are at an end. because he'd made so much money from the sale of all this stock that he'd looted. So yeah, he came across as a real bad guy. But like you say, he made his reputation defeating the French Navy in the Battle of the Saints, and a couple of the other, or well, one of the other admirals as well, Admiral Howe, also, albeit quite a lot later on during the revolution, who was in France, salvaged his reputation in the Battle of the, I think it was called the Glorious 1st of June. So some of the people that were initially held responsible came out of it and rehabilitated their careers, rehabilitated themselves, and others were just kind of mired in the controversies of the war for the rest of their lives. It destroyed their careers. And I thought the person I felt the most sorry for was Clinton, who was basically, still recounting the episodes that led to the defeat of Yorktown in the final years of his life. And actually George Germain as well, the Secretary of State for America, who was quite a poignant his was quite a poignant story. He had kind of entered the war under a cloud because he had been present at the Battle of Minden during the Seven Years' War, where due to some disagreement with the leader of the Allied forces in that battle, who was Prince Frederick of is it Hesse or Brunswick, or one of the states in Germany. They had quarreled the day before the battle, and he then didn't come to Frederick's assistance as quickly as he should have done, which basically meant that the Battle of Minden, although it was a victory for the Allies, wasn't as complete a victory as could have been. And he lived with the consequences of that for the rest of his life. He looked at the American War as an opportunity to rehabilitate himself, and it obviously had the opposite effect. And yeah, even on his deathbed, he was still discussing the Battle of Minden. I found that quite touching.
Yeah, so because with a lot of these, I think for most of these people that they, in general, they suffered like setbacks in the immediate aftermath, but are largely able to recover their reputations either from events that occurred fairly soon afterwards. So, like in the case of George Rodney or the Hale brothers, but in large part, I think all of them, apart from George Domain, I want to say, was somewhat sort of had somewhat like salvaged their reputations by the end of their lives, and had some sort of success, albeit with a greater or lesser extent. Some difficulties there. Yeah, I think, well, I don't know. The other thing, yeah, a lot of them surprisingly bad with money. I don't know why. Also, their wives seem like 20, 30 years their junior for some reason. It's just 18th century things, I guess.
I guess it was, but it was quite shocking. There was like, who was it? Was it the Isle of Sandwich? His mistress was like 16 when he met her, and he was in his mid-30s. And a couple, I think George Devane also had met his wife at the age of, yes, yeah, because he actually eloped with his wife, who was a noble lady. But she was like 16 when they started their relationship, and he was in his mid-30s as well. So it must have been, presumably it was accepted at the time, although they didn't seem to have had very kind of much support in their own lives either. So
Yeah, not too sure about that either. And then I a lot of them sort of, well, I wrote, so Lord Sandwich, I think he remarries because his first wife was murdered at some point. So again, that was another thing. Yeah, presumably much younger than him as well. What was the other thing that was kind of weird? Yeah, I suppose, well, not so much weird, but like the personal factor, like because all these guys were like married men by the time they got involved, and most of them had like kids. And it was just incredible to think of the personal toll that a lot of this took on them, because they were did seem to feel the personal impact of being separated for such a lengthy period of time. And for some of them, it was through some fairly difficult circumstances. Either they were dealing with a recent death in the family, or they experienced a death in the family during the course of this conflict. So yeah, that must be, I mean, coupled with the fact that they were basically had no option of resigning, or at least if they gave their suggested their intent to resign, it was very often ignored.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's something else that was a kind of key point that O'Shaughnessy made, was that most of the senior military commanders actually didn't want the roles that they were assigned. It was a very unpopular war even at the time, and a lot of the more senior generals in the British Army refused to be part of it. So the command kind of devolved onto less senior generals, and people that may not have found themselves in, responsible for entire wars had, in the normal run of things. But yeah, like you say, a lot of them, it involved them being away from home and away from their families for years at a time. And they endured quite a lot of like personal tragedies during those periods as well. So it was quite, yeah, it's quite poignant in places in the book.
Yeah, should we wrap up or not?
Yeah, let's do that. Do you want your final thoughts?
I can do. I think overall, I did enjoy this. I think it's quite interesting to structure it and kind of, I don't know what else you call it, like a point of view sort of approach rather than the chronological sort of story. Although in places it could feel like you're repeating some of the information. It meant that each chapter is fairly self-contained, and it definitely helps if, like me, you kind of like get interrupted while you're sort of reading it or doing other things. Did also like the audiobook as well. I got to read that, or listen to that, I should say. It's quite well done and engaging, wondering, yes. That the actor does vary between sort of high-flung British accents and American accents, which is an interesting thing, because I'm not sure like if the American sort of figureheads would have had strong American accents, considering a lot of them were born in the UK or Great Britain.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's another question I have. But overall, I did enjoy it. I guess the only weakness, and it's more just for my because of my own ignorance. Obviously, the fact that it's written from a British perspective, it does make it a little bit unclear as to what's happening on the other side, because it quite often feels like George Washington especially is just always like retreating from something, and then it suddenly turns around, and you're not really clear why. And it would be helpful to have a more complete picture as to why that was the case. But I can understand that's not really the focus of this book, and can't help that I don't know these things.
Yeah, no, I felt the same though, actually. I did feel that that was something I would have liked to know more about. But I think that's potentially a companion book then, The Men Who Won America, told from the perspective of Washington, Jefferson, and the various others who contributed to the American independence. But yeah, so you'd recommend the book.
Yeah, I would do. I'm not sure if you're completely new to this. I'm not sure it would be the best recommendation. But I mean, it's still an interesting read, and it was quite enjoyable. So I would definitely recommend this.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, definitely. And yeah, even I didn't really come into it with a lot of prior knowledge, but I thought it was quite a good primer as well. So yeah, definitely. Do you have a next book? Do you know what we're reading next?
I mean, to be honest, I don't have one. I had a few that I had in mind, but I still don't know what exactly.
Okay.
I suppose it's kind of up to, I mean, what would be, I wouldn't mind it. So reading the Rise and Fall of Great Powers, it did want me to get more involved in sort of early modern history, I guess. But I'm not too sure what.
Did I get that from you for my birthday?
Yeah, but I mean, I've already read it, so like,
Okay.
I mean, I could
I
read it
wondered
again,
if
but
there
it would
was a
be cheating.
subtle I wondered if there was a subtle hint that we might be reviewing this one. Yeah, okay. Should we go for that then?
Go for one.
The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers.
I've read it, mate.
Oh, okay. Well then you'll have to choose another one then.
I don't know. There was. I'll have to get back to you.
Perhaps like the Earl of Sandwich, we should debate this behind closed doors and then present a united front. He did evolve the idea of ministerial accountability. So that's yeah,
Well put.
let's follow in his footsteps.
The old sandwich defense.
Right. Well, great. Thank you for listening, and please join us again as we discuss a to be decided title.